Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that invades Spain first and asks questions later. My name's Corey Hazelhurst. I'm a partner of propaganda with Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
Now, in our quest to have every single Labour councillor from Birmingham on this show, we are joined today by councillor for, is it Hodge Hill, isn't it?
No, it's Shardend.
So Shardend.
Next door to Hodge Hill.
The professional operation, we know all the people who come here. So councillor for Shardend, John Cotton. Hello, John.
Pleasure to be here.
And you were a cabinet minister for Birmingham Council, weren't you? I
managed to hold three jobs in the space of 4 years in the cabinet. So I did social cohesion, and then I stopped off at health and wellbeing for a year, and then I ended up at housing for the final year.
You didn't do two at once, though.
No.
So you weren't the George Osborne of the Birmingham City Council then.
I'm still waiting for the offer to edit the Birmingham Mail. I'm sure it's on its way.
And at the moment, you're chair of the scrutiny committee.
Yeah, I chair the health, wellbeing and environment scrutiny committee, which means we've got all the stuff with the NHS, all the stuff with adult social care, and then randomly bins.
For those of us not quite au fait with local government as you are, that basically is a select committee type.
Yeah, it works on the same basis. So it's a cross-party committee, and we basically hold the executive to account over decisions that they take. Mm. So it keeps us busy.
And it's probably actually a good week to join us in our nuclear bunker after North Korea sending missiles, Trump deciding that he wants to send missiles because of beautiful babies. So I think it's a good day. It's a good time to be about 20 feet underground.
This is true. And you did clearly forget the fact that we went to war and then ended a war with Spain in the matter of days over Gibraltar.
So. That's true. That's already finished.
There were people dancing outside the tapas restaurants in King's Heath on Victory Day.
But we're not going to talk about impending nuclear war or bins or health today. We're going to talk about Brexit. Since we last met up and recorded these last few episodes, Theresa May, our Prime Minister, our mixture of Cruella de Vil and Sybil Fawlty, who reigns supreme in British politics, she invoked Article 50. And so we're going to have a little bit of a chat about how we think the negotiations are going to go and maybe what Labour's response should be as well.
After this jaunty theme tune.
Before we do that, though, can we first discuss the events that have happened since our mixture of Sybil Fawlty and Cruella de Vil invoked Article 50? Britain now will leave the EU in 720 days, apparently. It was March the 29th that it was triggered, so we've got 2 years of negotiations. Since that happened, we had Simon Heffer, who is a kind of a self-appointed intellectual guru of right-wing crazy people. And he wrote an article for The Telegraph, basically saying that we should bring back imperial measurements like pounds and ounces. And then Peter Hitchens, who is the self-styled maverick of the insane crazy right-wing people taking over the country, he put out a tweet saying that decimalisation was a sign of dictatorships and authoritarian regimes. I'm not even making this stuff up anymore, that actually happened. We've got so-called Tory MP Andrew Rosendale, who said that having the pink European passports has been a source of national humiliation, that they want to apparently spend £500 million on blue passports, which is about the same amount that we're cutting at the moment from cuts for people with disabilities. Also, this kind of macho nudge-nudge wink-wink, the British have got pink passports, so they're obviously a bunch of pansies. Makes no sense. But then we had Michael Howard. So it's one of those news stories where you're reminded that this person hasn't died. And it's always nice to see Michael Howard as well, because it reminds you of when Labour could actually win elections and were popular and could do stuff. And Michael Howard popped up on, was it Sophie Ridge, I think, on Sky? Someone in the EU27, I'm guessing, of Spain said, maybe we'll talk about Gibraltar in the EU accession talks. Michael Howard comes on to television and says, well, I remember a few years ago when one female prime minister sent a gunboat to an island to defend a thing, and maybe this will happen again. At which point, then the Telegraph starts putting articles saying, yeah, Britain could totally take the Spanish Navy. They're just kind of got long moustaches and play flamenco music. That's what Spanish Navy do. Since then, Theresa May has ruled out war with Gibraltar.
Thank God.
Which is good. as well as...
I was going to say, especially as it's war with Spain, not Gibraltar.
Yeah, but she's had time to do two things this week. One of them is make sure we've not had war with Spain. The other one was to condemn Cadres for not using the word Easter when it was using the word Easter. Which is my favourite non-story of the week, not connected with Spain. I suppose my question is, what the hell is going on and are these people all insane?
That's a really good question, to which I suspect the answer is probably yes. It's just been bizarre to watch all of this stuff unfold, the various degrees of craziness that we seem to be going through. I'm half expecting Drake's drum to be broken out next as we send the Armada down the channel to take on Spain. There was also something, I was struck by something Anne Perkins had written in The Guardian this week, where she said we needed to open some sort of safe space for these retired politicians who come out with crazy comments, the not helping category. I would hope that there are actually sensible Tories who kind of looked at that and went, yes, enough, Michael, back in your box, please.
With all of these people like Simon Heffer and Peter Hitchens, there's an element of the correct response should really just be tap them on the head and say, very well, you've written another really wonderful article, and then ignore them. To be quite honest, no one serious is actually suggesting any of these things. Yes, some backbench MPs, some former leaders like Michael Howard may be getting a bit into a tizzy over it all. They're not influential. Andrew Rossendale, I think he's a chair of one committee or another in Parliament.
Flag committee or something.
Yeah, it's not even a real committee. It's an all-parliamentary group for flags and heraldry or something. So it's
flags and heraldry.
Yeah, it really is. It
is 1408.
Yeah, which it means I can totally see why you would go to that person to talk about passports. But at the same time, it doesn't matter. His opinion on this doesn't actually, you know, hold any weight. So yes, we are going to get blue passports back, but the reality is we actually look at the passports once every 10 years or so anyway and go through a redesign process, which was due to happen anyway.
You've never felt humiliated by the colour of your passport?
No, I can honestly say I've never even really paid much attention to the colour of my passport.
And it's not pink, is it? Mine's burgundy.
Yeah, mine's burgundy.
It's a nice burgundy. It's a lovely colour.
Yeah. But yeah, so when you actually look at what... It feels strange saying this, considering that the people I'm talking about are Boris Johnson, Liam Fox, and David Davis. But when you look at what the serious grown-up politicians are doing, it's much less ridiculous. The colour of our passport doesn't matter. I think we'd all agree with that. Whether it's this burgundy, whether it's neon pink, or whether it's blue or black or whatever, it doesn't make a difference.
No, so it's where we can travel to with our passports that's more important.
Absolutely.
It's the price of our food rather than what measurements we have from it that's important. That's one of the reasons I'm worried that you just refer to Liam Fox as a serious politician.
And compared to those other people,
which
though,
shows the dire straits that Britain could well find itself in at the moment. The reason why I think that these right-wing insane people, that it's important that we see what they're saying, is because they're one of the constituencies, probably actually the main constituency that Theresa May needs to try and win over at the moment. Obviously, Theresa May beat Andrea Leadsom for the Conservative Party leadership last year. It didn't go to members, it was MPs who voted. And it was Andrea Leadsom who got the vote of the right-wing insane MPs last year. And so a lot of what Theresa May has had to do is to make moves to win those over, which is why she's been talking about making sure Brexit happens, and Brexit means Brexit, and it'll be red, white and blue, and all that kind of rubbish. Because, I think I'm justified in saying this, that the opposition from Labour generally, and over Brexit in particular, has not exactly been robust. Because nature abhors a vacuum, it's the right of the Tory party which is becoming the check on Theresa May's government. Which I think also politically is going to happen when your majority is 5, 12, whatever it is. I think what you've seen over the past 10 days or so is the reality Theresa May faces. On the one hand, she's got to say very, very nice things to the EU and to the European Parliament and MEPs so that we'll get a nice deal. So in the Article 50 letter, she talks about how Brexit is no rejection of the values we share, says that we share Europe's liberal democratic values, which got a big laugh from the Lib Dems when she mentioned it in the chamber, which is, as an aside, seems to be another sign that the political antennae of the May administration isn't quite where you'd expect it to be. She's got, on the one hand, to please, though, the EU. On the other hand, she's got to try and appease the mad, crazy people for whom any kind of deal from the EU is going to be a bad deal. If there's any mention of free movement, if there's any talk of paying any money to the EU, I mean, we'll talk about the divorce bill, I'm sure, soon. But if we pay £4 to the EU, then Bill Cash is going to come out on television and talk about how surely we should just get Germany to pay back the money that they owe us from the Second World War. And then everything goes wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the issues that the government is going to have, is that eventually all of the people who are quite happy and content at the moment, because they've actually won, it's finally happening, we're finally leaving the EU, eventually those gaps of insinuation of this is what Brexit is going to look like are going to become solid and actual real proposals, rather than just up in the air discussions. When that happens, it's going to be quite a job to bring some of those people along. Now, Bill Cash, for instance, is, you know, to be honest, I suspect the government's just going to ignore him in general, because, as you say, unless it's completely one-sided, where Britain maintains all the benefits of being an EU member, but with absolutely none of the paying in, Bill Cash will, you know, never be happy unless Britain's in a one-sided relationship with all the power. It's whether or not they can bring the Dan Hannans and the slightly more, again, I use this term loosely, reasonable, quote-unquote, Brexiters with them on this sort of... Basically, if they can make Tim Montgomery, who's the journalist who used to run Conservative Home, happy, I suspect they'll probably be all right in terms of Conservative Party management.
I don't know, because Bill Cash can vote to get rid of Theresa May tomorrow. I think Bill Cash is a more pressing short and medium term problem than Dan Hannan and Tim Montgomery are.
I think one thing I would say on that is that would be true if there were it was neck and neck in the polls. It's not.
I think that's right. I think actually May's in a position of not being able to have to overly worry about that extreme end of the party. It is very much that kind of centre-to-centre-right ground that she needs to keep on board. And I think that the poll position that she's in at the moment means that she's got quite a strong hand in terms of managing the Conservative Party. Obviously, as this whole thing starts to play out and we get down to the details of what a deal may start to look like, and of course the questions that come from the Labour side as well, if we start to set out a alternative approach to those Brexit issues, then, you know, we could be in a different place. But I think at the moment she's in quite a strong position in terms of her own party.
I wonder if it's as strong as it's going to get, though, because Theresa May is probably the most popular politician in the country at the moment. People have confidence in her to produce a good, in terms of the polling anyway, people have confidence in her government to get a deal that's good for Britain. However, it was actually Tim Montgomery who wrote an interesting article for CapEx on this. What she's been pretty bad at doing is setting expectations management, in that there's been a lot of talk that essentially Britain can have its cake and eat it. If you, again, look at the polling that YouGov's done on Brexit and what people want from Brexit, generally most people want to have control over immigration and retain single market access, which is not going to happen. And how May balances it and what Britain has to pay in to get single market access. I mean, we can talk maybe a little bit now about this free trade deal, and you can probably try and negotiate one. However, it's going to take a long time to do that. You've got French elections coming up 23rd of April, and then I think May the 7th. So we're not going to have Brexit talks until May. There are German elections at the end of September. So we assume not much is going to happen during summer recess. Well, not much is going to happen until September anyway. So by the time we get to October, November, we'll already have had 7 or 8 months where we could have negotiations happening. It took the EU 6 months to ratify a free trade deal with Canada. And then at the end of that, it was voted down because a Belgian regional parliament voted against that free trade deal. Pascal Lamy, apparently this week, who's the former head of the WTO, said it could take 5 or 6 years. So I suppose maybe the next thing we should talk about is that free trade deal. How easy is it going to be to make? What sort of things are we going to talk about? How long is that going to take, do you think?
I just cannot quite work through how we're going to reconcile all this with that timetable that you've set out. I mean, clearly nothing's going to really happen until the autumn. The German election is I think, you know, the key thing here. We don't know how that's going to play out. And then you're into a very short timescale to actually have very detailed discussions around how a free trade deal works, how you deal with all the issues that sit around that. I wish I knew what the answer was. I just do not see any clarity about how we get to the other side of this with something that's comprehensive and worked through and that will serve Britain's economic interests.
Yeah, I think the I think everything that John's just said there is pretty accurate. I'm not sure how you can square the circle of achieving everything that needs to be achieved in the timescale when there's so many elections that are happening. A shock result in any of the French or the German elections could you know, drastically change the situation. It is not inconceivable that, you know, it looks unlikely in the polls, but we could very well be dealing with Marine Le Pen as president of France. That, God knows what that does to everything if that were to happen.
It means we need extra baked beans in this bunker that we sat in.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of Germany, less opportunity for an internationally shocking result. Mm. But, you know, Angela Merkel could, for the first time, Angela Merkel could be ousted from power. Is it Schulz who's the new...
Martin
Schulz. Granted, he's still a pretty mainstream figure. Based in the heart of Europe, was heavily involved in the European Union in one position or other. I can't exactly remember which now. It's one of the many presidents of something or other they've had. Merkel goes, that changes actually some things.
I think it's different shades of difficult as well, isn't it? Getting a Brexit deal with Marine Le Pen is going to be very, very difficult. If you've got Schulz and Macron, then they're going to play very hard as well, because they're very, very pro-Europe. Mm. You're kind of screwed either way.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of the trade deal as a whole, I think it is going to be a very bits and pieces thing, which is probably going to be drawn out over time. And by over time, I mean beyond that this two-year window that we're now operating in. Which is why I think it's quite significant that there seems to be some kind of acceptance and realisation of this over the past week or so from the government, where they've started talking about, maybe there will need to be a transitional deal. Maybe we will need to have some form of, you know, Norway EEA membership on a time-limited basis up until a point where we can get this free trade deal sorted.
Yeah, the Institute for Government has done some quite interesting things on looking at what might be negotiated up for grabs in Brexit negotiations. And it's interesting that the difficult things in free trade deals, they tend to be the things that actually Britain would want to try and press for. So difficult things tend to be things like services, which obviously most British trade with the EU tends to be services. It tends to be competition law as well. Simple things, it says, like fisheries or Erasmus programmes, are only really simple if Britain is essentially going just to leave the common fisheries policy, but then basically adhere to the rules outside of it. I think, was it Greenland or Iceland that basically took 2 years to leave? It took them 2 years to agree a treaty, and all they had to talk about was fish. And yet, fish
there's
is...
There's multiple types of fish. There's tuna,
they're not
there's
herring,
the actual... there's...
It's not a chip shop.
There's roe, cod.
Some transitional deal looks like it's useful, but then apparently Angela Merkel isn't very keen on a transition deal.
But at the same time, in the document that's outlining like the European Commission and what's not's position on the talks, they've said that Article 50, for instance, is revocable. So there's lots of kind of to-ing and fro-ing with lots of different people kind of sticking their oar in. What we don't have currently is a set notion of what's going to happen and who's indeed kind of going to be calling the shots. Mm. And that's where those elections really matter.
I think it's we're kind of in the phony war, aren't we?
Yeah.
And until we see what comes out from the election process in the autumn, then perhaps the battle lines become clearer. Don't want to use all these military analogies, but I seem to have fallen into them.
This phony war period, as you've just called it, is quite apt. And I think that's one of the reasons that actually why the EU's been quite stringent in saying, no, we're going to sort out the divorce settlement first, we're going to deal with the money that you owe us and all those sorts of things, and saying that we won't talk trade until we've dealt with that, because I think those aspects are actually relatively easy to solve, actually, because there's it will basically boil down to the EU just saying we're not going to progress and we'll talk about anything else until you pay up. And so we'll end up paying up, which then means there's dealing with all of that will probably take the 8 months or so that we've got to wait until all of these elections or whatever are out of the way and done with.
Yeah, the divorce bill is an interesting one, isn't it? Because it wasn't mentioned in Theresa May's Article 50 letter. It also wasn't mentioned in the speech she made, was it at Chatham House, I think, in November. And you've got estimates from anywhere between 25 billion euros to 60 billion euros. Now, does that mean that extra £350 million a week that the NHS is going to get, is that going to be on top of the divorce bill? or are we going to take that money out of the divorce bill?
I think we need to get another bus.
I think, to be honest, the hope for the government was that the divorce bill would be one of those bureaucratic things which no one pays any attention to. Because really, who actually cares about the ins and outs of EU budget negotiations?
Bill Cash.
And yeah, what hasn't been Bill Cash that's brought it up particularly?
But well, there's the Bill Cash view of the world, and then there's the how do you paint the divorce bill up on the front page of the Daily Mail? And that's when I think the people will start paying serious attention to it, and government will do.
Should we finish off by talking about what we think Labour's response should be? For all the talk of division and for all the talk of impotence, I think actually a lot of the Labour Party is quite united on Brexit. I think it's quite on the same page. Most voted to remain, but most now accept that you've got to accept the will of the British people and that leaving the EU is going to happen. And if you look at the polls at the moment, that's kind of the consensus view, I think, of most British people as well. There hasn't been what YouGov is annoyingly calling regret. If you look at, I thought Lexit was the worst, but maybe regret is...
Regrets, I've had a few. Yeah.
There's not a sizable shift to say, oh, well, I think I've made a huge mistake. It'll be interesting to see if that happens in the future, because, say, if you look at the Iraq war polling, for instance, public opinion was quite massively in favour of that, and then shifted, and then people remembered that they were against the war when probably they were for it. So it'd be interesting to see if it shifts in the years ahead. Again, one YouGov poll said that I think 69% of people say now that Brexit will go ahead. And this is something you said to me privately, is that although you voted Remain, Steve, if there was a second referendum tomorrow, you'd probably vote to leave.
I mean, I think for me there, that's as much as a part of the fact that I know that the minute that something like that happens, and if you were to reverse that trend, that's when you gain more salience. That's when you run the risk of more kind of Marine Le Pen, actual kind of, you know, fascists and Nazis and things like that gaining traction.
I mean, the thing is, if you look at the root causes behind why there was a Brexit vote, you know, and I represent a ward that was pretty much 70-80% Leave vote. The reasons behind that weren't a sort of like carefully considered look at all the factors that govern the EU, you know, and trade deals.
Did they really want blue passports?
I don't think blue passports was the thing that was the highest on the list. This was about a kind of longer term disaffection with politics and how the system was perceived not to work for them. You cannot then turn around and go, you got the exam question wrong, you need to resit the exam. I mean, that is absolutely opening the door to all sorts of backlash. So I think, you know, we need to be in that position saying, right, well, there's been a vote, that's the will of the British people. It's now, how do we get the best possible deal that we can? And certainly the things, if I look at a ward like my own and a community like the one that I represent, is, you know, how are we going to ensure that things like jobs at JLR are protected? You know, how are we going to ensure that we get to a system of immigration that is, you know, properly seen to be fairly managed and is based on some fairly key principles that people want to see put in place? That's where we need to be.
If you look at, say, work that Emma Reynolds and Stephen Kinnock have been talking about, maybe trying to reform Labour's position on free movement, Corbyn's been talking about maybe reconsidering the position on free movement. Ed Miliband has come out against the second referendum. I think actually, although you've got a few people on one side who are very Brexity and still are, like Kate Hoey, and a few people who are very, very Remain, that's a small minority in the party. I think there's a couple of issues with that, though. Tactically, I think Corbyn's had quite a bad hand and played it quite badly. I think asking for Article 50 to be triggered the day after the referendum is one obvious unforced error. And the other major one was whipping the MPs to vote in favour of triggering Article 50 when Labour's demands hadn't been met, because Keir Starmer and the shadow Brexit team had a load of very sensible things that they wanted to see in the Article 50 bill, like Parliament having proper scrutiny over the final result, about making sure that we safeguarded access to the single market, and those demands weren't met, and Labour voted to trigger Article 50 anyway, which I think just puts Labour on the wrong side of history, really. Again, going back to the Iraq war example, the fact that the Tories voted for the Iraq war in 2003 meant that they couldn't make a lot of the political capital out of the fact that the war went very badly, because they were already in the position of supporting it. And so if Labour tries to make political capital out of any of the incompetences we've talked about, I think the response will be Well, you voted for it anyway, so what have you got to complain about?
I mean, that is actually probably one of the few rare areas where actually it being Corbyn who's been in charge could actually be, in the medium to long term, be beneficial for Labour, in that you can just say, Jeremy Corbyn, not us, that was Corbyn. And people would actually go, yeah, that sounds about right. When it comes to Labour as a whole, though, to be honest, I think when you look at a lot of the things that Keir Starmer's been doing and some of the things he's been coming out with, it's pretty much, I think, what needs to be happening and what needs to be done. The problem is it's either a bit too late or it's not been given the kind of exposure that it otherwise would have done if under a more competent leadership.
Isn't that because the media bias that isn't reporting it, Steve?
Absolutely. It's got nothing to do with the fact that journalists are emailing, Labour HQ and various shadow ministers and for quotes, and they're not getting back to them until after they've had to file their copy. Not at all. There wasn't an entire Twitter hashtag filled with this for journalists complaining about it. And even when they do it, there's some wonderful ones like Debbie Abrams, Work and Pension Shadow. Paul Wall from the HuffPost had gone to Debbie Abrams for a quote on something. And they said, yeah, we'll make that request to get that information for you, and then we'll provide you the quote. They did got the information, and then emailed Paul Wall back, basically saying, sorry, no, we're not giving you this quote. We're not going to give you the information. We're going to run this with The Guardian instead because it's a bigger story than we thought. And that was how they were treating the Huffington Post, a broadly left-wing website, which is on their side.
And how Momentum treated the New Statesman. Like, if you've lost the New Statesman's Labour Party,
that's
then you're
brilliant.
I mean, the solution to this, and we have been saying this all year, listeners, is to fire Seamus Milne out of a cannon.
Yeah.
One reason maybe that Labour's strategy may go awry is it may well be that politics after the referendum, where people's political identity becomes that of Remain or Leave, there is some evidence to suggest that more people are now identifying with their referendum result than a political party. If Remain and Leave becomes the issue of political identity of the next few years, then I think Labour's position, although nuanced, although probably the right, maybe the only place it can be in, then actually they will be the party in the middle of the road that gets run over. And again, I don't think that's not the leadership's fault. I think that's just because Labour's the only main political party that is losing voters to Leave and Remain voters. It's very easy for the Lib Dems to set themselves up as the second referendumers and get their 15-20% vote share from that, and maybe more in other areas. It's easy for the Conservatives to be the party of Brexit and get the Leave voters, and that leaves Labour really struggling in the middle, probably regardless of its leadership. But as I say, I think Corbyn's had that bad hand and played it badly.
Oh, I think there is an issue for Labour because it's kind of a foot in both camps, you know, constituencies that heavily Leave and heavily Remain. I'm not so sure that whole idea that identification of people's voting habits will be built around a Remain or Leave identity going forward. I think it's kind of a symptom of the phony war that we were talking about. Because it's kind of big, broad concepts, you're either in or you're out. It's easy to make that judgment as to which tribe you're in. When we start to get down to the nitty-gritty of, well, you know, is it a free trade deal? What does this mean for my jobs, my prospects? What does it mean for my public services? There's a whole set of other more ideological policy-based arguments that play in, and I think it won't just end up that we're sort of divided into a Leave tribe or a Remain tribe. So I think there's more hope for traditional party politics, if you like, than might be the case at the moment. But it is, we've got to get past the autumn, we've got to see the detail of what's actually on the table and how that plays out.
Okay, so that is some sort of hope, maybe, for the future of the Labour Party. What about the future of Britain after Brexit, then?
The government seems to be kind of leaning much more towards at least being open to the idea of transitional controls, transitional deal of some sort across a number of different areas, which, if we do get to that point, which I think certainly seems more likely now than it did a month or two ago, we are going to be left with a potentially quite bizarre situation where we'll go through that two-year period, we'll still be in that transitional situation, at which point we'll be coming up to a general election here in the UK, which will then mean, okay, we've then got to have an election about the future of Britain. That debate will then become a part of it. Do we want to remain within this transitional arrangement? Do we want to continue trying to work out a bespoke deal and go into lots of different complexities and therefore, you know, end up focused on nothing but the EU for the next decade? Or do we want to just crack on with it and focus on some other things and say, we're out the EU, this deal is actually all right, the British people as a whole seem to be all right with this, therefore we'll stay, we'll tweak the edges or not, but we might just stay there. And
even though the likelihood of a Labour victory at the next general election doesn't look particularly brilliant at the moment, to say the least. The reality is the situation is very, very fluid, which means you could still end up in a situation where a government led by the Conservatives that isn't headed up by an Andrea Leadsom type figure isn't going to want to push that too far, too quickly, which means eventually the Tories are going to end up out of power, which means, you know, there will be another left-wing government of some description in the UK, which means they're much less likely to go for a more bespoke option for the relationship with the EU, which will then mean we'll just be stuck with where we were with this transitional deal, which will basically be where Norway is, which is a load of the benefits, not the full benefits of EU membership, and a load of costs.
So you're saying that the best case scenario of Brexit is that this is all a massive waste of time?
Yeah, pretty much.
Seems like a good enough note to end on, doesn't it, chaps? If you enjoyed this episode, what's wrong with you? No, if you enjoyed this episode, please can you subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. If you can tell whoever you can, however you can, it really helps people discover the show. We're expanding our empire. We're building a new Fabian bunker next door. And I'm hoping that with Luke John Davis, who's been with us for a few episodes, we're going to try and record a few episodes with a West Midlands bent. We're going to have, hopefully, the first one should be out next week about the mayoral election, which you may or may not have heard about. We are taking back control in the West Midlands. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. That's on license from Creative Commons. And our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Centre Radical.
And I'm at Councillor John Cotton.
We'll be back next week. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.
See ya.